Future Proof with Jonathan McCrae on News Talk.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof, the podcast. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. My name is Jonathan McCrae. Thank you for subscribing, downloading, rating. Coming up on this week's podcast, we're going to be talking about the smells of the past, archaeochemistry, and how we might be able to identify what a T-Rex armpits might have smelt like way back when. If you'd like to get in touch with the show, you can email us, science@newstalk.com. We get to all of those comments at the end of the pod. First up, as always, it's time to look back at the breaking news from the world of science this week. Our first story, John, has to do with the Milky Way.
Yeah, that's right. So just to give context, the Milky Way is the galaxy we live in.
Yeah.
It's a really cool galaxy in the sense it probably has really extended spiral arms. So think about a whirlpool. It kind of looks like that. Because we live in the Milky Way, it's kind of like living in a forest. We can't see it from the outside, but we can look at other galaxies that look similar, or we think we look similar to the Milky Way, and they look really, really cool. And that's why we think the Milky Way looks really cool as well.
Hang on a second. We don't know what the Milky Way looks like.
You can't look at it from the outside, right?
I've seen loads of pictures of the Milky Way.
Have you? Yeah. They're mostly artist impressions. They have to be.
I guess they do have to be. Now, when I think about it logically, I guess they do have to be that.
Yeah, way. Yeah. No, they definitely do.
But can we not like look out the window and see like a bit of a curve and then infer that they've, like if we look all around us, can we not just composite that? Or
you can look a little bit, but you can't see through the galactic center, for example, because it's really dense and you can't see that, right? Mm. Because the Milky Way is essentially a disk. So you have to look through the disk if you want to see the other side. And you can't look through the disk.
Yeah.
You know, you just can't. Also, I want to talk about two things. One, it's really massive in terms of how many stars it has. It has about 100 billion stars, okay? And we can count them, like not individually, but, you know, statistically, right?
And just to give people like frame for that, right?
Yeah.
That's just one galaxy. And there are billions, if not trillions, of galaxies out there.
I would say trillions of trillions.
Yeah. 100 billion?
100 billion stars in...
just in the Milky Way.
Just in the Milky Way.
And then all of those have planets.
I would, yes.
Most.
Yeah. As far as everywhere we look, we see planets. Yes, absolutely. So the number of planets is a multiple of that number.
So it's big.
Absolutely enormous. It's very hard to get your, you know, head around that. But the other thing about... that was the first thing. The other thing is how big the Milky Way is in terms of its radius. Okay? And now we think the radius of the Milky Way is 12 kiloparsecs. So kiloparsecs, I can break that down. That's 40,000 light years, if you like. So the question then is, how do we know that? And that's the crux of this study that researchers from Berkeley in California looked at. So what they did is they look at the ages of stars. And they have to look at a certain subsection, actually, because it's hard to gauge the age of all stars, but you can look at a subset. Okay? And the oldest stars are actually in the center because that's where they started forming first. And then as you move out, you get younger and younger and younger and younger.
Yeah.
And then we can see where that limit lies. Mm. And that gives you kind of this U shape. Because once you hit that limit, it starts to tail upwards again because you got older stars in the outskirts that have radially migrated outwards.
Right.
So eventually you stop forming new stars, if you like. And what the researchers found is that happens at around 12 kiloparsecs. And again, that's 40,000 light years from the center.
So that's 40,000 years at the speed of light.
Correct.
Oh, wait.
Exactly. Put that in context, the Earth, so us, News Talk, lives 26,000 light years from the galactic center. So when we take pictures of the galactic center, as we do relatively routinely, we're seeing it as it was 26,000 years ago.
Wow. I love hearing about like the bigger stuff in cosmology because it does give you this sense of immense insignificance, which I could do with dollops of a lot of the time. Jess, our second story has to do with volcanoes.
That's right. And when you can trust a volcano or not. You know, because if you think about volcanoes, obviously there's the big dramatic picture that we might have of like one erupting. There's also volcanoes that are dormant. So, you know, they could erupt soon, but they're not erupting at the moment. And there's volcanoes that are extinct. And for small volcanoes, they're defined as extinct if they haven't erupted in about 10,000 years.
Mm-hmm. I know this because my son has just completed a school project on volcanoes.
Oh, very. Mm. Baking soda?
Going to do Mentos and Coke.
Okay. All right. That's also a legitimate choice. But so, you know, when a volcano is classified as extinct, a lot of times you might think, oh, there's just nothing going on with that volcano. Like nothing is happening. It's not active in any way.
But there's snaky ones out there.
Exactly. There's this new study from ETH Zurich where they basically went and looked at the specific Greek volcano called Methana. It's about 50 kilometers from Athens. And they looked at the history of Methana through the geology and through the rocks, kind of in the geologic record. And they looked at what it had been doing for the last 700,000 years. And the way that they did this is by looking for the specific type of crystal called zircon that's basically formed under immense pressure down in sort of the bowels of the volcano and the magma. And they found basically by where the zircon was in the ranges around this volcano that it had erupted for a while, and then about 280,000 years ago, it stopped erupting. And then 168,000 years ago, it started erupting again, and it's kind of just been going off and on ever since. So a long, long period where it did not erupt at all for about 100,000 years. But deep down in the Earth, it was still forming these zircon crystals at that time. So what that means is that there was still magma underneath the volcano, you know, even if it was, like, extinct by this sort of fake 10,000 years rule, like, there was still geologic activity underneath, and obviously eventually it did start erupting again. So if you want to know whether a volcano is going to erupt or not, like, looking at this sort of historical record isn't that helpful unless you also know whether it's producing this zircon underground. Mm. What they think, the reasoning for this is that basically they think it has to do with the water content of the magma deep down. So basically, I didn't know this, but magma has to have a certain amount of water in it, a certain percentage of water. Otherwise, it becomes very, very, like, not quite solid, but very viscous and hard to move. And then it effectively can't erupt.
How does magma have water in it?
It has a little bit of water in it.
That was my question. Is it not all evaporated?
No, it's not. This is what I learned researching the story. So you have to have some amount of water in the magma. Otherwise, it can't flow through these channels within the earth. It can't get to the surface. It can't erupt and become lava. So it's super, super interesting. But it also kind of has to do with, for these smaller volcanoes, like whether or not they will, you know, potentially go dormant for a while, but then erupt in a much bigger way because the magma got all blocked up. And that's when small volcanoes can turn into these kind of super volcano-like caldera-forming systems, which for me I found really interesting because actually where I grew up in the U.S. is very close to a caldera, so to an extinct, like, super volcano. And I shouldn't say extinct because...
Who knows?
Yeah,
there's some
exactly.
shaky ones out
going.
There. They've been snaky on you.
They're going.
Got to be careful.
Our third story has to do with one of the planets in our solar system, John.
Thanks, Jonathan. Yes, Uranus. So there are 8 planets in our...
You didn't say it the fun way.
you just don't know what comes out.
Go on.
So there's 8 planets in our solar system. There are 4 inner rocky planets, which we all know, which is, you know, Earth, Mars, Venus, Mercury. But there's also the 4 outer planets as well, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune. Okay, so Uranus is the 7th one, so it's a long, long way away. Very, very cold, but really, really cool. So, for example, I don't know if anybody has seen it, but there's a really cool kind of GIF, I guess, on YouTube or whatever, Twitter even, of showing the spins of the planets. Uranus spins on its side. So everything is like this. So I know you can't see, but in a disc. And then Uranus is like 90 degrees to that, probably because there was a massive collision early in the formation of the solar system. And so it knocked it onto its side.
Mm.
Very, very interesting. The other cool thing is that if you were on Uranus, you'd get 42 years, and at the pole, 42 years of light, and then you'd have 42 years of darkness because of, like, you know, its distance from the sun. So like we have, like, you know, here at the Antarctic or Arctic, we have 6 months and 6 months, but it did have 42 years and 42 years. So that would be a long winter by anybody's standards. But anyways, the actual story is about the dust rings around Uranus, okay? So These have been looked at by a collection of telescopes over the years. So ground-based, which would be Keck in Hawaii, and also Hubble and JWST most recently. And they're trying to understand basically what makes these or what constitutes these disks. So there's 2 of them. They're called Mu and Nu, but I can't remember which one is which, so I'm just going to call them the blue and the red. That's way easier because that actually makes way more sense as well, because one of them is blue and one of them is red. The blue one is made up of icy kind of grains, 1 micron size, so really, really tiny, but they're made of ice.
Hmm.
Okay. And it also, the variability goes up and down. So what they think, or what they're fairly sure of, is that there's a moon, tiny one, 6 kilometers in radius. So it is tiny. I was like, how did they find this thing?
Cool moon.
I know, but tiny. tiny, and it keeps getting hit by meteorites, knocking the water off the moon into orbit, and that's basically your little ice little crystals, and that's the blue ring.
Okay.
Okay. The other ring is the red ring. So that one is more, it's larger particles, so they're more like dusty grains, and because they're larger, they absorb the light, and then they reprocess it and emit it in the red. So that's why we see it in
a
the
red
spectrum.
Yeah.
Yeah, a red shift, basically. And that's the red dust ring. We don't know exactly, or they can't see with JWST, where the source of that dust is, but it's probably a moon in that ring as well, but we just can't see it. But that's it. That's the the dust rings from Uranus.
There you go. Our final story, Jessamyn, has to do with ghosts. If any science story has ghosts in it, we're going to do it.
This is like the most incredible example of mismatch between a paper and how it was reported that I have to say I've like ever seen.
Oh.
Well, it's interesting, right? Because basically... what they're looking at is the way that people perceive sound and sounds that we can't hear, but how they affect us.
Okay.
Right? So sometimes people will go into like a house or a place and say, like, this feels creepy. Like, I don't like it here. Like, there's something wrong. Like, something bad happened to someone here. And it's
News
often...
talk gives that
every time I come into the building, yeah.
Oh, no. Yeah. Well, look, there's a lot of research around, like, what type of things could cause that feeling. Right, which is often associated with, like, for a certain type of person, the supernatural. Uh-huh. But it's also like, you know, if we think about how we perceive the world around us, we mostly think about our senses. Mm-hmm. And in terms of what we can hear, there's a sound range that we can hear. It kind of bottoms out at about 20 hertz. So, like, sound is a wave, 20 sort of cycles per second. And anything below mm-hmm. that, that's like lower frequency than that, is called infrasound. And so what this new study did, it was done by researchers at McEwen University in Canada. Is they basically took a bunch of people and they played little audio cues for them several times that were either calming music or kind of unsettling music. And they either had infrasound playing under them or they didn't. So, you know, they checked, could these people somehow detect the infrasound frequency that they used, which was 18 hertz? No, they couldn't. Like, they got people to try to predict. There was no correlation.
Right.
But then when they looked at the people's response to this music, you know, the calming music should sort of reduce your cortisol. It should make you feel better. You should report your mood in, like, positive ways. And the unsettling music would raise cortisol, this, like, stress hormone that they detected through the saliva. And, you know, it would make you describe your mood in worse ways. And basically the presence of infrasound changed how people reported understanding the music and, like, listening to the music. Both their own sort of self-report of their mood, they were more likely to describe themselves as, like, irritable, stressed, sad. And the cortisol, the actual, like, chemical measurement, was also different. Like, the cortisol was spiked whenever there was infrasound playing versus when there wasn't, regardless of, like, the emotional tone of the music.
Right.
Yeah, even though, so they can't detect, you know, these people are not detecting the infrasound somehow, but it is having a physiological effect on them and then on how they perceive their own mood, which is really interesting and weird. And the thing is...
It's not surprising, though, that we're, you know, that, I mean, because it is, you know, it is something our body feels, whether or not we, our brain feels it, our body feels it.
No, 100%. And I think that's the thing, infrasound, like when it's at very high volumes, you will feel it as a sort of a shaking. So this is basically just saying, you know, at low volumes, you are sensing it as well. And it can change the way that you feel. But it's probably not from ghosts.
Yeah, where are the ghosts?
It could be from infrasound, from like pipes, boilers.
Okay, this story was very light on ghosts. I was promised way more ghosts.
It's disproving ghosts.
Dr. Jessamyn Fairfield and Dr. John Regan, thank you very much. Yes, welcome back to Future Proof on News Talk. I'm Jonathan McRae. If you'd like to get in touch with the program, you can email us, science@newstalk.com. We get to all of those comments in detail in the podcast. Now, when we travel somewhere extraordinary, we speak of the sights and the sounds, but something often gets overlooked and yet forms a major part of the essential experience of any place or time. It's the smell. And this important facet of day-to-day life is entirely missing if you visit somewhere like Pompeii or Angkor Wat. What did it smell like? And is that smell lost forever? Well, Dr. Barbara Huber is an archaeochemist at the University of Tübingen in Germany and has found an ancient Roman perfume. She joins me now. Barbara, what exactly is an archaeochemist?
Yeah, that's a good question. An archaeochemist is a person who combines two different disciplines, so archaeology and chemistry. And what we are doing is we study archaeological questions and the past by using chemical methods. So, for example, when you're interested in ancient diet, for example, then we can analyze chemical traces, remains in archaeological potsherds, for example, in cooking pots or other sorts of vessels, and based on that, reconstruct with what people ate in the past or drank or cooked and so on.
I always wondered about this because I've heard about, read about it in newspaper articles. How does a molecule for coffee or beer or a certain type of bread, how does that persist? How does it stay around for thousands of years? Does it not just disappear?
Not all molecules stay. That's one of our biggest issues that we face. But we have molecules that are very persistent and very stable. And so they can survive thousands of years. And sometimes they get incorporated in the, for example, the porous matrix of a potsherd. So that it's basically inside the pot, gets soaked in with oils or fats or any kind of liquids that were in the pot. And now we can then, for example, drill into the potsherd. And by releasing some of the powder, we also get some of these ancient molecules out. But sometimes we're super lucky. And for example, we have perfumes still preserved. And so we have the entire perfume left. And then we can just take a sample of that.
Okay, we'll talk about the perfume in a bit. But in terms of how far back you can go and get something, like, is there a limit on that? Like, say, for example, you managed to get some artifacts from Göbekli Tepe in Turkey 11,000 years ago. Would you be able to actually see what that was, or is that too far back?
No, that's totally in our range. We can go even further back. We can go tens of thousands of years more back, and people have analyzed samples from way older sites, and they have identified molecules. So yeah, analyzing something that is 11,000 years old is totally possible.
So you talked about the gaps of the molecules. And of course, any smell, if we're talking about reconstructing a Roman perfume, for example, there's a number of molecules that combine together to create a scent. If some of them are preserved and some of them aren't, then how is it possible to really know what something smelled like?
I would say it's almost impossible to 100% reconstruct the scent. But what we try to do is we try to reconstruct the ingredients that were present. So, for example, if a resin like frankincense, for example, it is composed of a lot of different molecules, not just one molecule. And so it has some of the molecules that are super volatile and they probably evaporate very fast, like with perfumes right now, yeah. Right? In modern perfumes. You spray it on and some of them are just gone very quickly and others last longer. And so these ones that are lasting, we call them biomarkers when they're very typical for a substance. So, for example, frankincense has biomolecules that just remain for a very long time. And if we find these molecules, even though if not all of the entire molecular suite of frankincense is preserved, if we find some of these molecules, then we can still say frankincense was present.
Right, and like a footprint or a fingerprint.
Exactly. We have done the fingerprint of frankincense. And then we have, for example, the fingerprint of other substances, beeswax, resins, herbs, flowers, and so on. And then we kind of reconstruct the recipe, the composition of the perfume. And based on that, we recreate it. But if it is 100% how it has smelled in the past, we can never know because we're not able to test this.
The Roman perfume that you found, can you tell me a little bit about this? Because this was found in Bonn. This is a really exciting find. What do you know about it?
Yeah, this is a really cool project we just started. And here we would like to know a little bit more about the northern provinces of the Roman Empire. And this is Bonn is in this region and also other sites in this region of Germania Inferior. And so we are interested in whether or not perfumes are the same, if there are like different fashions, if people in the northern provinces, because it's like a frontier zone with other different cultural preferences, so if and also different raw material that they have available. So we are interested in what can perfume tell us about the society, about the identity of people, about adaptation processes, and also the selection of different ingredients. And one perfume there is really fascinating because it is sealed. So it is a very beautiful glass bottle, and it has a stopper, so it's completely sealed.
Wow.
And what we saw inside is that it's still liquid inside. And most of the time, that's not the case. Usually, you know, perfumes, when they're based on oils, they dry out with time.
Yeah.
And we usually find the kind of dry remains of the perfume. But this time, because we see inside through the glass, we see that there is liquid inside. And so we could use a very fine needle and go through the stopper to extract a little bit of this liquid that was still inside to analyze it. We haven't done it yet, but we're super curious what we might find out.
Now, even though it's in a stopper, presumably the smell wouldn't preserve over that level of time. I mean, there has to be degradation of molecules just over time, surely.
Exactly. So we assume that a lot of the very volatile compounds are gone already, but preservation like that, and we have worked with way less preserved samples that gave us relatively good results.
Right.
So we are very hopeful that we can get at least partially odor profile of that and have a good idea with our reconstruction methods to get as close as possible to the original.
I suppose in those days they would have had fairly rudimentary sort of ingredients that we can still find today. So if you recreating those scents presumably is theoretically possible if you happen to know if you had a good perfumier, you could probably have a good idea of what the ratios might be, and recreating that Roman scent might be theoretically possible just from the chemical basis, right?
Yes, exactly. And this is also the reason why we work with a perfumer, because the knowledge a perfumer has in blending different things together is very important. And we also have Roman texts that talk about specific ratios and so on. So if we put all the evidence together, the ingredients that we might find out in the Roman perfumes, ideas about blending and ratios, and having the knowledge of a perfumer and the nose of the perfumer, so to say, we hope to get close to the original.
We can also learn a little bit about culture and anthropology and the movement of humans, right? I mean, if we have a particularly interesting ingredient that's found in one of these molecules, it can tell us a little bit about the people who owned it and how it may have got there.
Yes, we can. I think perfumes tell us a lot about ancient societies, all sorts of aspects of ancient life. So, for example, when you have a very luxurious perfume that is composed of exotic ingredients that only a small number of people had access to, we learn about the status, the social standing of this person.
Right. So rich people can have exotic smells.
Exactly, right. Yes. Or some scents, even today, you know, are very associated with a certain identity, with a certain group, or with specific rituals. Mm. Think about the Catholic Church and burning of all these frankincense, or indigenous communities burning sage and other smells that are very associated with specific settings. So this is also something we can learn about perfumes. And what you mentioned before, the trade aspect is super interesting, because some of these ingredients, they grow in very specific geographical regions, and they cannot easily be cultivated somewhere else. So they have like a clear kind of origin and natural habitat where they can grow. And when we then find them in all sorts of different sites over the world, we know about the movement of these substances. Mm. And this can tell us about connectivity in the past, the trade connections people have, the exchange networks they were able to set up, and so on.
Say you come across something where the ingredient is no longer easily found. Do we have the technology today, if we know the molecules, if we know what the molecules would have been, do we have the technology to recreate any scent using chemistry?
Yes. If we know the molecules, we can use synthetic molecules. We don't need the plant itself. But knowing the molecular composition is the important thing, because there are a lot of extinct plants. And if we cannot understand their molecular structure, their molecular composition, we also cannot recreate them, right? But if we would know the molecules, yes, we could synthetically recreate.
Is that a very expensive process?
It depends. It depends how complex the molecules are to do the synthesis. But if you have like a composition of molecules that are readily available to purchase, when you can just buy the standard, then this is totally possible. That's not so expensive.
This technique, is this the same sort of approach to archaeochemistry that's used in understanding the belly of Ötzi the Iceman, the ancient man found in ice near the Italian-Swiss border?
Yes. With Ötzi, it's a different. I think a lot of people used ancient DNA. So these are different types of biomolecules that can give us several different information as well. Yeah, you could theoretically use DNA also to ID substances in a perfume. The problem is that very often perfumes are kind of cooked, so heated over a prolonged time. And heat denatures proteins, for example, and also DNA. So if you have like a high heat treatment, this would not be the preferred technique. But DNA, in theory, totally is possible also to use for perfumes.
What about kind of stuff that we don't have evidence for? And like, for example, the breath of a velociraptor or you know, the smell of London in the industrial times. Is it possible to piece what those scents were together?
I mean, you can you don't need molecules to do a reconstruction. You could also use other types of information, for example, textual references. When you have texts that talk about the, I don't know, acidic smell of London or the kind of smoke in the air that filled your lungs or something like that, if you have these literal accounts, then you're also able to do a reconstruction. Then it's just not based on molecules, but based on other accounts.
And where is the future of this going then, Barbara? What do we look at for the future of archaeochemistry and what is the use of it?
So what we did with our project is to actually recreate the scent, because bringing it into the museum and not only have this kind of abstract information, these molecules, but bringing it back to life. So visitors in the museum can actually kind of get back into the past or travel into the past with their noses a little bit. We call this a time travel for the nose. It's just a multi-sensory way of experience the past. And so people are not just using their eyes in terms of going through museum and looking at objects, but they experience a little bit more the sensual aspects of the past. And for the longest time, the past was pretty odorless. And now we try to bring back a little bit of the smell of the past.
Absolutely. Although, you know, there are some places you don't want to go back to. Like I have a feeling that Renaissance Paris stank really bad. I have a sense of a really, really bad smell.
There is a recreation in the Jorvik Museum in York about, I think they have like a huge coprolite. So it's basically poop, ancient poop.
Yeah.
And they have done a reconstruction about that. I would also not be a fan.
No, it's not something I'm going to flock to a museum for. Dr. Barbara Huber from the University of Tübingen in Germany, thank you so much.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Have you ever read the book Perfume? What a novel. It's unbelievable. It tells the story of this very sort of underling fella who has an incredible gift for scent. And if you really want to be taken on an incredible adventure, just so sensory, because what Barbara's talking about there, like, you know, smells are really tied to nostalgia in our brain. And if we smell something, it can bring us back to somewhere really, really quickly. And Grenouille is the main character, if I remember correctly, from Perfume. And oh my God, what an incredibly visual and chaotic story, but you will love it. And it ends so well. So if you haven't seen it, don't bother with the film, but the book is unbelievable. The reason why I didn't like Paris, by the way, the reason I thought Paris might be a bit is because of the obsession with perfume at the time, and also the fact that they threw their shite out the window. So those two things sort of add up to not a great place or time to smell. I didn't, for those who are avid listeners to this program, I did not correct myself when I said fingerprint to Barbara, but I must do it now. You know, a fingerprint is not something you leave on an object. That is a finger mark. Fingerprint is what's on your finger. So when we say, look, oh, they have fingerprints on the glass, they did not leave fingerprints on the glass. They leave finger marks. Bit of trivia for you. You want to stay with us, we're going to go through some texts now. If you'd like to comment on anything you've heard, you can email us at science@newstalk.com. We were talking about AI And, you know, like, I have this love-hate relationship all the time with AI. I was giving training on Copilot today, and man, Copilot sucks. It's such a terrible program. But AI has got an immense amount of potential, but some people are kind of, kind of sick of it. I get that. And particularly if you follow me on LinkedIn, I'm always banging on about AI. It's endless. It's intolerable.
Just try hanging around, would you?
That's uncalled for.
I was just talking about AI.
Producer Aidan McCovey joins me to go through your many texts and tweets from last week. You're clearly so keen to engage with the program. The first text says, AI is wildly unreliable. Could we please focus on the planet first? So a couple of parts of that, right? First, it depends on what you're asking AI to do. AI can be wildly reliable, although no one tends to use that phrase, but it depends on what you're asking it to do. What people are mostly want AI to do, it's wildly unreliable, but there's lots of stuff AI does well. Could we please focus on the planet first? And that, I always find that funny. It's kind of like this argument, Aidan, about, you know, why do we go to the moon? We've got problems right here on Earth. And I guess the idea is that we will all, is that we could all focus all of our resources at one time on one thing and solve one problem. And of course, that is insane, because if everybody starts just working on health, then what about everything else? Right. Mm-hmm. And there are other, I mean, yes, global health is really important, but there are other things that are also important, like dogs. Right.
Didn't expect the dogs to be the next word.
Or maintaining roads, yeah. Or, you know, it depends on what it is. You know, electricity grid. If everyone worked on health, then the electricity grid would fall over, whatever it is. So we have to look at other things. And then the idea is, could we focus on the planet first and then go back to AI? And that is an interesting question, because right now, a lot of the AI people have been saying, oh, AI is, it's going to destroy the world. Well, why don't you stop making it then? Oh, because everyone else is making it. That is genuinely a breakdown of what the leaders of AI have been saying. And I think we should stop with the AI.
Oh, you think we should just stop doing it? Until, so you actually agree with the texter?
Until we figure it out, I think we should stop. I mean, it's not that it's unreliable. I think it's getting more reliable and more good at doing certain things. And that's what's scary. I think we should just stop for a second and go, all right, if we keep going and if we look at everything we've done and where we're going, it's not hard to imagine where the not too distant future will take us. And the question is, are we ready in any way for a society where AI can do a lot of what we do? Now, there's a guy in Cork, his name is Professor Barry O'Sullivan. I'm going to be speaking with him at Tech Fest, right? And he's been on LinkedIn. A lot of the time after I post something, he'll say, AI is completely overhyped. And I always feel like, if I looked over my shoulder, I'd see him there. I don't think they're related, but he's constantly like talking down the potential of AI, and particularly, not so much the potential of AI, but he's often saying AI is not going to displace all of our jobs. It's going to be negligible. And that could be true. It could be right. He's in the minority, I think, of those people at the top. A lot of people who are at the very top, looking over the edge, feel like, or at least are saying outwardly, that it's going to displace a lot of jobs. But we just haven't talked about what that future looks like. Science fiction people have, and, you know, most science fiction novels do not end well.
No.
And if that's the only frame of reference that we have for what the future is, that's not good. So we need to figure out how we do it, you know? I was in Brixton last week. I was talking about AI to some kids in Brixton, right? Real, getting real. And
keeping it real.
And they were really interested, you know, about, you know, what it could do. And I played this song that I'd made, and they were all like, oh my God, that's really cheesy and this is horrible. But like, they were intrigued to see that you could just make something like that. And I was saying, this doesn't need to be the end of creativity. Actually, you could use this and then think, what would I change? What instruments? Why don't I add something from myself? And I feel like there's huge potential. But you could just say, let AI just do everything and then let it wash over and wipe out all traces of genuine humanity. I think it's a bad thing.
I'm really surprised as you're saying, I wasn't expecting you to go down the road, because this makes for bad radio, but I totally agree. Like, I think it does. Like, we had Jeff Kloon on talking about the AI scientist 2 weeks ago, and he was the other end of that hype market. He had said to me in the briefing call that he kind of thought within 10 years the world would be completely and utterly unrecognizable.
Mm.
And whilst that could be exciting, it also could be terrifying. And I think even in the internet age, sometimes I feel like Mrs. Doyle in Father Ted, where I'm like, I like the misery. Like, it's good to learn
you
things.
You don't love change.
I don't. No, it's not about change. It's that I like learning things. And I like simple things like, we forget, I think, that the smartphone in our hand is a tool. It's not, it shouldn't be entertainment. It's primarily a really cool tool that if someone 30 years ago was told they'd have it, they'd be like, oh, well, that's great. I'll use that if I get lost and, you know, in some town, or I'll use that if I need to know what happened to this character in a biopic. Any of just kind of things that you might want to know, it's great for that. But we just kind of outsource a lot of our thinking to that. So you get to a point where people are rubbish at directions now, like absolutely terrible, because they're just like, I'll just look at Google Maps.
I don't know. People bang on about that as an example. Wow, you can make your way from Dublin to Limerick without looking at the car signs. Like, honestly, that's your greatest achievement. Who gives a shit? Like,
one of my many great achievements. I know
what North Northwest is. Who cares? Like, honestly, that's not a super skill in 2026.
I'm not saying it's a super skill, but it's like an enjoyable part of being a human being to learn things.
No, for sure. But don't have. I think it's wrong to have a hierarchy of things that are good to know and things that are not good to know.
But you just said that was a rubbish skill, so you have a hierarchy of things that are good to know and things that
I'm
are bad to know.
I'm only countering your, oh, wouldn't it be great to be able to make your way around the world without having to look at your stupid phone?
But that was only a little flippant example. But I guess the thing is, with AI, I don't like the idea that lots of people will outsource their creativity or outsource their thought process. And people will do that.
Like,
you see people, you know, scrolling on phones, and it's like, I don't want to have 5 seconds to think. 5 seconds, I think, would be bad.
You're right. And one of the things that is very dangerous about this absolutely frictionless experience in commerce in the world, you know, if we want food, we press a button on Uber Eats and it arrives and we don't even barely see the guy, we just take it and the whole transaction. The lack of friction in our lives has made us very, made it difficult for us to have proper development of a personal identity, right? Because we're not, you know, life is about awkward moments and about this is difficult and that was hard and, you know, like, and if everything is so easy that it's bit, then, but then I order a lot of stuff on Amazon.
But it also eliminates the need, the necessity to know, you know, when something is in season as well or something like that, because you just get it at a click of a finger.
We were speaking to Dr. Charlotte Blees about Dr. Bot, her book, where she looked at the experience of patients and how maybe technology might help. Joan says, "You're so right. I get 5 minute tops with the doctor, €65 each time, and always feel too pressured to go through all of my concerns. There's also a sign in the waiting room stating that you only have 10 minutes and that if you have multiple concerns, you need multiple appointments. This really does not help patients." Yeah, I did that once. I went into my GP and I said, they were treating my son for something. And then I was like, oh, and while I have you, do not while I have you a GP. You do not while I have you a GP. Even if it's something like instant.
I always do that.
You can't while I have you. You can go in and say, look, I have a couple of symptoms or, you know, there's two things, but you can't while I have you with another person's appointment.
Yeah.
That was bad. I felt bad. I didn't realize until afterwards. I was like, yeah, I suppose.
It is a pity though. Like I've gotten into that bad habit because I had a childhood doctor who, you know, all the time I lived in my hometown, he was my doctor up to about 25, 30 years of age. And he, all his appointments, you could assume it was going to be 45 minutes after that because he would take as long as it needed. And everybody knew that. And he was a lovely man and a great doctor, but his whole schedule was an absolute total mess. Mm,
yeah, there's probably a milligram. Well, that's it from us in this week's episode. Thanks to Aidan McKelvey producing, Rory Galvin on podcast, Hugo De Silva Scott on sound. Thank you for listening. We'll be back with more Future Proof in your podcast feed on Tuesday. In the meantime, stay curious.
Future Proof with Jonathan McCrae. Proudly supported by Research Ireland. Sunday from midday. News Talk. Conversation that counts.